Hi, everybody. This is Katie.
And this is Jake.
And you're listening to A Date with Dateline. Don't panic. Kimberly is fine. She is taking a week off and will be back with us next week.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we have Jake of Date with the Bake fame. In case you didn't know, we have another podcast about the Great British Baking Show. And Jake is our third co-host on that. And Jake has been a guest on A Date with Dateline. Are you a three-timer? Four-timer?
I think this is number three.
This is thrice.
Thrice is nice.
Thrice is nice. We're very happy to have you here, especially for this episode, which was a doozy, to put it nicely.
A lot of turns in this one.
A lot of turns. Also, a lot of first-time things. Jake is here, but we have a new host. Let me introduce the episode, and then we have to immediately go into Blaine Alexander and how wonderful she is. Okay. Mm-hmm. Today's episode is Justice for Joy, which is season 32, episode 35. It premiered on April 12th, 2024, with new host, Blaine Alexander.
Yes.
I don't think she's been on Dateline before, but it's been discussed that I have a goldfish brain. So she could have been. I could have missed it.
I do think this is her first episode, based on some of the comments I was reading.
Do we think this is an audition, or do you think we think she's a new addition?
I felt like in the intro they said new host, actually.
I am thrilled then. She knocks it out of the park with this episode.
Yeah, she's great.
She was really good. She did not shy away from really difficult questions, especially in regards to the police in this case, which is hard.
Right.
Okay, so let's get into this. Mm-hmm. Blaine Alexander, welcome. We're very, very excited to have you. Here we go. Justice for Joy. We open with what appears to be a 1990s family video from a camcorder. We do find out it's 1991 later. Mm-hmm. Blaine tells us if only they could freeze this moment in time. And we're introduced immediately to David, Joy, and Angie Hibbs. And Charlie is behind the camera. Charlie is the dad to David and Angie. Joy is the mom. A young family, Blaine tells us, facing a future they never saw coming. Just 11 months after they took this home video, Joy would be gone. Good job, Blaine. First intro, right to the point. We go immediately to the date of the crime, which is April 19th, 1991. We are in Bristol Township, Pennsylvania.
Bristol and then Bristol Township. So I don't know exactly how townships work, but that may be smaller than counties.
Here's my question. You grew up in the Connecticut. So
I did.
In the Connecticut, you have townships?
Not that I'm aware of.
Really? I'm just wondering because it was my first introduction to townships was when I moved to Allentown, was when I moved to Pennsylvania.
I feel like that's a Pennsylvania thing specifically, kind of halfway Midwest, East Coast type of vibe that it's got going.
It sounds like a fancy town.
I'm not sure what the specifics of the incorporation or what it is communicating by being a township.
Is this just Pennsylvania? Is this just Pennsylvania being difficult?
It could be Pennsylvania stuff.
Well, I don't know, but we're in Bristol Township, Pennsylvania, and it's only important because Bristol Township gets the business in this episode.
Literally, New Jersey is across the river from
that sounds like Allentown.
Location. I know, right?
Okay, bizarre. Yeah. We are getting an interview immediately with David Hibbs, who is the young man we saw in the home video. He's now grown up.
Mm-hmm.
This happened in 1991, and he was just a kid. Blaine says, walk me through that day. And he says, well, we had a new puppy in the house, which is super exciting. And it sounds like a pretty adorable way to start the day. So dad scoops up this new puppy, puts the dog in the bed with his mom, Joy. And then scoops up little kid David, who I'm guessing is like 11 at this time, 10 or 11.
Yeah, there's a decent gap between the kid's age, I've noticed, right?
I think it's about 5 years.
Okay, gotcha.
I think Angie, the older sister, seems to be about 16.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing he's between 10 and 12.
Yeah.
So scoops him up, puts him in the bed with his mom, Joy, and the new puppy. It's really cute. It's like a movie. It couldn't be a better way to start the day. Unfortunately, it does turn out to be probably the saddest day in David's life. But the morning is fairly straightforward. Charlie, the dad, leaves for work. Angie, the older sister, the high schooler, heads off to high school. David has a normal day at school. I mean, it's a little exciting. He gets the honor roll.
Right.
Were you on the honor roll? Did you ever get that sticker?
I caught a couple honor rolls. I'm a pretty erratic student. So we get honor rolls some semesters. Maybe we crash and burn. on the next one, and then we have to talk to our counselor or something about it. Who knows?
I love that. It was an erratic. So on this particular day, school is let out early for David. He's excited to get home, and he's really excited because he's trying to catch his mom before she leaves for her shift at work, because he wants to tell her about the honor roll play with the puppy. Yeah. He gets off the bus. He's excited because he sees her car is still in the driveways. But as he walks up to the house, he sees through the vent on the side of the house that there's black smoke coming from this vent. He goes around to the back door, opens the back door, and of course there's this huge plume of black smoke, and he sees flames. Mm-hmm. So he takes off down the street. And by the way, he and Blaine are actually at his former home at this point, and he's pointing at the house. It's kind of spooky because also the house shows no sign of there ever being a fire there, but we come to find out this is a pretty intense fire.
Right.
So he's screaming for help. Neighbor calls 911. He's trying to get back in the house to rescue his mom, but the neighbor grabs him and won't let him go. And finally, emergency services arrive and put him in the back of a car to, like, keep him calm and out of the way as they go in to try to tackle this fire. Now we meet two firefighters, Tom and Kevin, who are on the scene. And they say when they go into the house, one of the first things they notice is the stove. And as they're moving through this kitchen, they see that all four burners are on in the stove. So right. Immediately we know... Not yeah. an accident.
This is not an accidental fire.
Right. Joy did not leave all four burners on. Mm-mm. Now we meet Angie, all grown up, who is Joy's oldest daughter, David's older sister. She hears about the fire and rushes home. Angie, by the way, is a beautiful older lady now. David is also a very handsome older gentleman. I just yep. have to mention it because it's hard to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
So Angie's talking about what's on her mind as she's rushing home after she hears that there's a fire at her house, is that she had just been shopping with her mom for her prom dress. And so she's worried that her prom dress is caught on fire, which is such a 16-year-old
yeah.
reaction. I just did prom dress shopping with my niece about a week ago. And I can tell you that would be all that she's thinking about if that dress was lost.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. I would hate that. I feel like she's holding on to that detail, and I feel a little bit bad for her that she had a moment of maybe a little bit of selfishness.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And like, oh, no, my dress. And she's like, you don't know the full scope of what has gone on here.
I do. But isn't it also that thing where you just would never assume that
right.
something...
I think that's exactly the case, that it's out of the realm of conceivable.
Because this starts bad. Like a fire yeah. at the house is bad. And gets so much worse.
Yeah.
This is a lot for a teenager, mm-hmm. for kids.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Oh, we do get to see a picture of Angie's prom dress, which it's teal. Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking about it in Fashion Police because it is.
Talking teal.
Talking teal. If you think of 1991 prom, this is.
Yeah.
It's the one.
How did teal just burst out in like 1990?
Do you think there was teal before the 80s and 90s? When we look at pictures of the 70s, I don't see a lot of teal.
I feel like there was a time when it was like turquoise was more dominant. I know like turquoise and teal are really, really like one has more blue, one has more green.
Yeah, they're friends.
Yeah, they're related. But do you feel like maybe teal maybe supplanted turquoise?
It was like, we want turquoise, but turned up bigger, more turquoise, but more.
Right. Exactly.
It's like the unnatural color because turquoise is a real color.
Right. Maybe that's it, that like turquoise happens in nature.
I don't know if teal occurs in nature.
I mean, it must, but I don't think it's
does
like
it?
A, you've got to imagine there's got to be some plant or flower that has some sort of teal look to it.
I don't want to get letters from the botanist, Jake. I don't know. The botany community is coming for this
you
podcast
think,
already.
You think?
Probably. Okay, we have a lot of green stuff in this episode. Let's just, we'll move on.
Yeah, true.
So the firefighters say as they're going through the house, they see what is unmistakably a charred body. It's so charred that they can't tell if it is a man or a woman at this point. And these two men are very sweet. And they say training does not prepare you for something like this. We right. immediately knew, though, that we had to shut our hoses off and we had to get out of there because now this is a different kind of investigation. Mm-hmm. And one of the firefighters gets sort of teary. It's a very human moment because you can see that it affects him even today.
Sure.
First responders, great job. Your job is very difficult.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you. We owe you a debt. So at this point, David in the back of the ambulance needs to be informed that his mom is not making it out of the house. And it's a horrible series of events. He tells his sister, who's now arrived, mom is not in there. Mom didn't make it. And Angie says that she can't comprehend what she's hearing because, okay, forget the prom dress. She also sees that the puppy is out on the lawn and she's like, how did the puppy make it out of the house? And my mom didn't make it out of the house, which is totally understandable.
Yeah. Angie has excellent instincts, right? In this case.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's the first one to suspect that this things are not what they seem here.
Right. Charlie, at this point, has rushed home from work, Joy's husband. At one point, he just leans up against his wife's car and is sobbing. And we do actually get a photo of this.
Right.
From the time. It's hard. And David tells us that this is the first time in his life he had seen his dad cry.
Mm-hmm.
Blaine asks him, how did that make you feel? And he says, well, I was scared. I'll bet you were. Because mm-hmm. we do get some information about Charlie later that he was probably a pretty brusque guy. So, yeah, that would be really scary.
Yeah.
To have a pretty stoic dad sobbing. That's rough.
Right, right.
So I think that Blaine actually does a really good job at the beginning part of this episode walking us through that day. It just gives you a real sense of the stakes here. We hear from the fire captain Marshall now, who tells Blaine that there seems to be multiple fires that have been set in the house with no connection to each other. There's a fire in the bedroom, a fire just inside the kitchen, and then a separate fire happening on the stove, which had junk piled on it.
And the trash fire, right?
Was the trash fire the one at the edge of the kitchen?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the one that's right inside. So mm-hmm. no doubt arson. We knew before, but now it's... someone had set these fires.
Yeah, unquestionably.
But we find out, shockingly, the fire is not Joy's cause of death. I was surprised.
I see.
This did not seem like that kind of case. This seemed like something where she may have been drugged and left something, mm-hmm. but that there was not a murder on top of murder, which is what's going on here.
Yeah.
In her autopsy, there's no smoke inhalation in her lungs. Joy's rib cage had been crushed. She was stabbed 5 times, and it appears that there was strangulation as well. So major overkill right. here. Just yeah. a lot of stuff. But clearly, yeah. murder with arson as an after effect to get rid of evidence.
Right. It's a feint. It's a cover.
Right.
Best case scenario, it looks like an accidental fire. Worst case scenario, it doesn't look like an accidental fire, but it's still destroyed any physical evidence.
Any physical evidence and chance yeah. of conviction is small in the 90s when we don't mm-hmm. have some of the stuff that we've got today.
Right.
So now we learn a little bit about Joy herself. We hear from both of her children. She was a beautiful, kind woman inside and out. She loved the outdoors. They used to go camping. Everything was outdoors, fishing, mm-hmm. gardening. We also learned that she was from the South, so she had a really sweet, charming Southern accent, which mm-hmm. we hear at one point. She's playing with like this hamster. We get a lot of home video, which is, mm-hmm. again, I like when we get so much of the home video. But Jake and I just read some of the comments on Patreon before starting here, and people were really affected by this case. And I absolutely see why, because you feel like you know her from these home videos. Mm-hmm. It's so personal. And we get her playing with his hamster cage, and David walks in and says something snarky, and she goes, well, excuse me for living. And it is a really cute Southern accent.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you point out about the footage, because it's like this is the first time in the timeline that we are on mm-hmm. where there would likely be, you know, they just got a new camera and they're filming stuff because it's neat. And you've never had that. No one's never had that. We never had phone, you know, cameras on our phones
yeah.
for a couple of decades. So it's like the first time people can document themselves.
Do they have a filter on video now that will do 90s camcorder? Because that would be a great filter
to have.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the most popular Snapchat filters.
No.
Grungy VHS.
Oh, that's great. Skit,
like tracking lines and everything, and even the wrong date.
There's something that's really quaint about it. And there's something about the great equalizer of camcorder. Mm-hmm. Nobody looks good. Nobody looks good.
Yeah.
It's just such a weird, like, shadows in places there shouldn't be shadows. It's bizarre.
I had to pay money to go to school to figure out why that was.
Really?
Yeah. I kind of know why. It's like lens optic stuff.
Sound off below if you would like Jake to do a TED Talk on lens optics. Thank you.
I'll probably just post a link that describes the differences between lens lengths.
Darn it.
But, you know.
It's fascinating. It's really, weird phenomenon. It's a great equalizer.
It is.
We also find out at this time that her and David were actually particularly attached, where David was her little shadow and would always be by his mom's side, which is really hard. And then find out a little more about Charlie and Joy's backstory. High school sweethearts, met in high school in Florida. They got married after high school, had kids, and settled in Bristol Township. Charlie worked construction, and Joy actually at some point went back to school to get a certification to become a medical assistant. Mm-hmm. David said both him and Angie were really proud of her. Angie also describes that her mom and her dad's relationship was really loving. And now Charlie is, I guess, what you would describe as, what we call him, rough and tumble, rough hewn, rough and ready to rumble.
Rough, but a heart of gold, something like that. I mean, he's like a sweet biker guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
In the day, I think nowadays he would definitely be described as a lumbersexual, but.
Oh, I see. Can you clarify what that is?
It's a sexy lumberjack.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, okay.
I think back in the day, he's not scary by any means today, but he was definitely described as scary back then.
Yeah.
You understand him. When we get to see a lot of pictures of him, we'll get to it in Fashion Police, because he's got some amazing clothes in this. And Joy was not someone who was really into makeup, but super into her hair, which is right in line with the time period, and would always make sure her hair was perfect. And he's got this giant beard. So they're both kind of into hair.
Which was a very unpopular look, if you think about it. The beard was like...
At that time, yeah.
At probably its lowest popularity in my
I would guess a mustache was in more popularity.
Absolutely, yeah.
He also has a lot of visible tattoos.
I thought that was funny because I was like, for 1991 he does, but like...
Not now.
Not now. People have full sleeves and stuff.
Oh, you wouldn't even think about it, but he definitely has a half sleeve on the one... He has a forearm.
He's got a few on the forearm, yeah. But I just thought it was funny because I'm like, well, yeah, for the time.
For the time, he didn't have a neck tattoo, which would have been like, oh, you're a criminal.
Sure.
But like, he has visible tattoos with a t-shirt on.
And multiple. Wears t-shirts and is not trying to hide them.
And does not care, right.
Point taken.
He was also into motorcycles, which helps with this whole sort of image, right? But Joy loves all of that. She loved doing the fishing and the outdoors stuff with Charlie. She also loved riding on the back of his bike. Find out later that this is not like a biking mafia. This is a biking group that gives to charity.
Sure.
But losing Joy was a real loss for the whole family in a bunch of different ways. David reiterates that his life is forever changed. He never feels really safe anymore.
Right.
But he's not the only one, because this whole town is caught off guard. And at this point, we meet Colleen Kelly, who plays kind of a big part in this. I thought she might be a throwaway interview. She is not. She is Angie's high school friend.
Right.
Who says her mom woke her up the next morning with the news that, like, hey, Angie's mom was dead.
And her eyewitness testimony is key to identifying.
She doesn't know it yet, but it's super important.
Yeah.
Investigators, unfortunately, a lot of evidence has been burned away, so they don't have a lot to start from.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see any signs of forced entry. They do find Joy's wallet, which is empty.
I'm frustrated that they don't have much evidence when the first responders seem acutely aware that they have to immediately behave differently in the space when they discover the body. It's a little frustrating to hear that, like, oh, so much physical evidence was stomped away when they said they lead with, oh, we saw a body and we knew immediately.
And we turned off the hoses, was what they said.
Who bungled what?
Well, it definitely wasn't fire.
It doesn't sound like it was fire.
It seems like fire knew exactly what was happening and was like, okay, this needs to be protected.
Right.
The fire marshal tells us also that, so besides Joy's wallet, which is empty in the living room, the fire marshal gives us a term that I had never heard before called full involvement.
Yes.
Which is what he describes the bedroom where her body was found.
Mm-hmm.
He says the fire is basically like wall to wall. It's
all four walls, ceiling and floor.
And into the hallway. So it encompassed that room. Yeah. Hot.
Well, right. So it's like the door is closed, but then you open that door and it's immediately going to shoot out into the hallway if that's the option, right? Because it's like burning so hot.
That's like why you learn as a kid to test the doorknob.
Exactly
is
right.
Is because yeah. of that. Mm-hmm. But full involvement, I'd never heard before.
I also had not heard it, and I was like, oh, that's an interesting term.
Goldfish brain activate. Remember full involvement. Because if I could use that, people might...
And you could also say, I am fully involved in your conversation right now.
That doesn't...
And have a completely different meaning, and no one would know.
That it's a fire sale inside my head? Is that what that would mean?
Burning
it's a
with
fire
rage.
Sale!
Oh my, okay. They're having a fire sale.
If you haven't watched Arrested Development yet, I can't help you.
I'm sorry.
So Blaine now interviews a local reporter named Joanne, who had reported extensively on the murder of Joy at the time. And Joanne carefully looked into the last hours of Joy's life. So here's our breakdown timeline. Joy needed to be at work at 2 p.m. that day. In the morning, she ran errands. After the kids were off at school, she went to the bank, got some cash. She went to the grocery store. At about 11 a.m., she returns home. And we know this because there are eyewitnesses in the neighborhood that saw her at 11 a.m. return home. Also, just after 11, there was a knock at the door, and it was the pastor and a parishioner's assistant, something like that.
Right.
She had apparently been to Easter services a few weeks before at a local Baptist church, filled out a card that said, oh, if you have some interest in joining our congregation, would you be open to a house visit? And she had marked yes. 11 to 11:45, we know they were there. Maybe this church was starting, so maybe they were like
true recruitment
up and coming
drives.
And they were trying to get a building a congregation.
We're out here for you.
But 45 minutes is a long time for that conversation.
That's a long time. What are we talking about here?
Your walk with God, Jay. Pull it together. Yeah. And maybe she was trying to like make coffee and the coffee machine was acting up. Who knows? We don't know. But the important thing is 11 to 11:45, David is home an hour after that at about 12:50. So they're right. able to now narrow down this time. The fire was set and she was killed between 11:50 and 12:50. This is big. Also, they found David's clock in the fire and saw that the time had been literally burned into the clock, stopping it at 12:54.
Right.
Which means the fire was burning hot and heavy by 12:50 for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's rare that we get this nicely lined up.
Yeah, that clock stop and they give you a time roughly.
And that all these neighbors had seen that she was home at 11. They had seen a pastor pull up. Like they knew all this stuff was
right.
going on.
Right.
But the pastor and his assistant are looked into. And of course, they have super tight alibis. They're discarded pretty quickly. The police move on and need to find other people who could tell us what happened here. But they hear about some troubles that the family had been having leading up to the fire. A brick had been thrown through the Hibbs window about 2 months before Joy's murder. They brushed it off at the time, just thinking, oh, it's just kids is kids. Sorry, I saw that on a Judge Judy once. I'll never get over it.
Oh, really?
The guy comes out of the courtroom. You know, they do the little courtroom interviews afterwards. And he goes, ah, kids is kids.
That's kids is
kids.
Kids
is kids, Jake. But I think there's a big difference between a baseball through a window and a brick through a window.
Sure.
Now, as a troubled teen, were you known around town for throwing bricks through windows in Connecticut?
No. I only threw rocks through windows one time in Oklahoma. Before I understood, I think it's like the first time I ever was explained the ramifications of my behavior. Mm. So I smashed it because it was like a cool sound and it was like, oh, what is that? I've never done it.
And you're a little boy.
I'm a like 4-year-old kid. And my mom was like, we have to pay for that now. I was like, how much does that cost? And she was like, $75. I don't know what it costs. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh, okay. And we can't just leave it. She's like, we don't own this place. And I was like, right. Okay, my bad.
Did you have a bowl cut when you threw that rock?
Probably.
Oh,
yeah. I might have been wearing bib overalls with no shirt also.
And a bowl cut. I just want to set the scene for everyone in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
That's quality.
But yeah, so I didn't break windows as a teen.
And a brick through a window feels like the mob.
Again, a baseball, oops, like physics went weird for a second. We hit the ball a certain way. So sorry.
Sorry, Mrs.
A
Hibbs.
A brick is like,
I'm going to hurt you.
Also, I mean, what if somebody's sitting in the chair next to the window and they get a brick in the face?
Or glass in the ear. Yeah, no.
Right.
But very shortly after this brick through the window incident, the back door of the house is kicked in, like kicked mm-hmm. in, and it's like yeah. falling off its hinge. And Joy asked both David and Angie, do you know anything about this? And especially Angie, who's a right. teen.
Right.
Are you feuding with one of your girlfriends?
Well, they're also saying, are you a troubled teen who is prone to breaking in windows and doors?
More like, do you have friends who are troubled or have right. troubled boyfriends who are coming and vandalizing?
Do you or someone you know have a problem kicking in windows or doors? Are you a troubled teen?
Don't send them to a camp. Okay.
Don't do that.
Could someone just be taking this? Could this be extreme teen? Extreme teenager. No.
I mean, doesn't really seem like it.
Doesn't seem like that. Because then 2 weeks after that, Joy's car is vandalized and it's the 4 slash tires that gets me.
Okay, right?
That's a knife.
Yeah, that's a knife.
At what point are you in a hotel, though? That fast in a row.
Yeah. So what is the timeline again?
2 months. They're all happening within 2 months of each other. So they're like a couple weeks apart. This is not like 1 month and then 6 weeks later, 6 months later. Yeah. It's not. No. Very fast.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd be pretty scared.
I might send the kids to stay with grandma.
Right.
And I'm surprised they didn't go to the police.
Yeah.
But I guess not. And we find out why, because I think they were probably worried about getting in a different kind of trouble.
Maybe so.
But police are asking, of course, David and Angie, if they know anyone. They're trying to get a list of names together that could have a beef with Joy or the family at this point. Angie's giving like a list of classmates, but it doesn't really help. But the police do manage to check into a few of them. They also look into a sanitation worker who had been spotted behind the house.
Right.
I don't think that day. But in the time frame around it, they also do background checks and interviews on people who were even seen at the grocery store when Joy was there. They could have followed her home. We also meet Vinny right now, who is another reporter from Philadelphia who worked on this case since back in the day.
Can I pause you for a second?
Yeah.
Do you think that stuff was wheel spinning? Learning what we know later, do you think they were doing a little dance, a little investigative dance for the public?
See, that's what's weird is normally when we hear about these cases, a lot of times we get tunnel vision from the jump.
Uh-huh.
And it would be the only focus from the very, very beginning would be Charlie. And so would be the dad.
Yeah,
and
of course.
This
yeah.
seems like they actually did quite a bit of legwork around it, which I see, right. like, do you protest too much?
A lot of legwork moving, but they don't do some legwork. You know what I mean? Running down people who are at the grocery store. Takes right. like real effort, but
I don't know.
It feels bizarre. Like it's part of the shuck to me.
They even look into the mailman.
Right.
There is a fill-in mailman on this particular day that they're looking into. They're just trying to look for anybody, but they're really coming up empty.
Right.
Remember Colleen Kelly, the mm-hmm. high school friend who was Angie's classmate. She said that she saw something the morning of the murder.
Mm-hmm.
She remembers driving by the Hibbs house and she saw a blue Monte Carlo parked really weird in front. It's like tail was sticking out and yeah. was going the wrong way. Like someone had like gone,
yeah, it's pulled in. Yeah.
Yeah. In a real hurry. She mentions this to David and Angie, and David immediately says, that's got to be April Atkins. So April Atkins was a very close friend of Joy's and a former neighbor. April and her husband Robert and their kids had lived 2 houses down from the Hibbs for a long time. And April used to come over and spend hours and hours in Joy's kitchen just talking and hanging out. David had very different memories about Robert Atkins, mm-hmm. April's husband, who had a really explosive temper. You could actually hear him yelling at April from 2 houses down. He also recalls a phone call that becomes pivotal. He had clearly in this phone call heard Robert Atkins yelling over the phone at his mom. So he asked his mom when she got off the phone what was going on, why was he yelling at her? And Joy kind of has to tell him because he overheard the conversation, but it's an uncomfortable topic.
Sure.
Because the yelling was about marijuana.
Yep.
I don't know. David is 11. I think Joy did probably the exact right thing in this situation, which was tell him the truth.
Yeah.
Because if he overheard any of the words, the key words in this topic, he's going to put things together that are wrong. And so best to just tell him the truth.
I feel like she did the exact right thing, that you can have a conversation. 11 isn't too young. You can still explain that it's not for them.
That's what
until they're adults, you know. So I think
he said that she handled it in the way that you handle alcohol.
Right.
It's like drinking. It's not okay to drink alcohol, but sometimes adults do.
Exactly.
Discourage it, but be right. Like, this is sometimes something adults do. He said that she really normalized it.
Right.
Which is seems good. Joy seems like a very good parent. But that's what the yelling call was about.
Yes.
And I'm just impressed that I think an instinct would be to lie.
I will say that, I mean, as a child of parents who smoked, like, that was a conversation that was had with me. So that's why I kind of recognize it.
Oh, wow.
You don't want to think your parents are criminal drug addicts. You know what I mean? So maybe it's okay for them to explain to you that it's okay for them to explain the difference.
That's perfect. So Joy tells David that her and her dad, Charlie, had bought green from Robert Atkins. And there was some sort of dispute about quality, something about it being all stems and seeds, something like that.
So what we call Nebraska No-High. Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
That's actually from my dad.
Is that no buds? Is that what that means?
Yeah, it just means it's specifically swag, you know.
So they want to return this purchase. It's unsatisfactory.
Which I thought was a little funny. I was like, you guys know you can't return
it. You can't return it. I think they just were trying not to pay.
This was the one question I had because I felt like the weight quantity might be different than what was let on. But there's no evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, we don't know.
But it seems like if it was over this specific transaction,
right,
then that was a total overreaction.
Yeah.
Felt like maybe there was more money involved, but it does not appear to be the case for whatever, you know, so.
I know.
It's a pretty mindless reaction.
Yeah.
To someone having problems with the quality of your product.
Yeah, you think? Okay, but Robert Atkins is threatening them because of this.
Yeah.
Bought it from Robert. So David tells the police all about this conversation because Robert Atkins is a little bit scary to David as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only person coming to his mind that he could possibly be involved here. So the police start looking into Robert Atkins. Now, he has sort of bounced around jobs. He was a bouncer. They say he was at one point a fledgling sports memorabilia salesman, which I have a lot of questions about.
That immediately sounds shady. I'm just saying sports memorabilia. I feel like there's lots of ripping and...
Sports memorabilia salesman sounds like you're selling fake baseball cards.
Right. Or like fake signed baseballs and stuff.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fake signatures. He drove trucks sometimes, but the police have a really hard time believing that this would be a murder over a $20 drug deal gone bad.
It is madness.
It feels odd. So Robert comes clean to the police with all of this stuff about selling them not satisfactory product. He says, yeah, they were unhappy with me. We've been having a little bit of a dispute, but I am no way involved in this arson and murder. And beyond that, I can't be because... By the way, they weren't living two houses down at the time of this murder. They had recently
right.
moved like 8 miles away. They're
yeah.
still close. But he had a phone call at his own apartment at the time of the crime, so he thinks, and took his kids to the Poconos for a vacation.
Beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Is that where?
That was like a Poconos commercial that used to run in perpetuity. In that area.
Have you been to the Poconos?
No, I'm not even sure where the Poconos are. I think there was like a popular honeymoon destination. The commercial would have hot tubs and of course, you know, dirty dancing.
Oh, and dirty dancing.
That's the vibe.
No one puts Jakey in a corner. So,
that's right. Hey, real quick, I just wanted to say $20 in 1991 adjusted for inflation is $45.86. So we are not talking about a lot of money still.
Still not a lot of money.
Not like, oh, well, $20 in 1991.
Is 150 today. No,
right.
It's not. No,
it's 45 bucks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, that's ridiculous.
Totally absurd.
And while we are on the topic of inflation, I have another I word for you. And that word is investment. I know that I should be saving and investing, but I've always been overwhelmed at the thought, so I just keep putting it off. Even if I got started, how would I know if I was doing it right? Which is why I was so excited when Acorns reached out to sponsor today's episode. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert built-in portfolio that fits you and your money goals, and then automatically invests your money for you. So head to acorns.com/datedateline or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Client testimonial may not be representative of all clients. Tier 1 compensation provided. Compensation provides an incentive to positively promote Acorns. View important disclosures at acorns.com/datedateline. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. Please consider your objectives, risk tolerance, and Acorns fees before investing. Acorns Advisors, LLC, Acorns, is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are provided to clients of Acorns by Acorns Security, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. For more information, visit acorns.com. Thank you, Acorns. If you are looking to squirrel away your nut for the winter, what better place to start than with Acorns? So the Atkins family that Friday afternoon had checked into a hotel in the Poconos. But besides this great alibi Robert Atkins is providing, police bring in Colleen Kelly, the high school friend who saw the blue Monte Carlo, to identify the Monte Carlo. They point out a car in a parking lot, and she says, well, that's the kind of car, but that's not the right color. She was sure she had seen a blue Monte Carlo, and the car that they point out to her is black. And the Atkins own a black Monte Carlo. Are we going to take the word of a teenager? Apparently, yes. And she says, that's not the color of the car that I saw. Yeah. So it definitely causes the police at this point, though, to put the Atkins aside as suspects. They have alibi and the car. This all sounds sort of fine at the beginning here.
Yeah, it's like all that, but like, you know, da-da-da-da. Like, I feel like all of this investigation is Bobo.
Well, stop jumping ahead. We're not to the Bobo yet.
But now that I know what I know, it all feels performative.
Yeah, that's true. I see what you're saying.
Like, oh, the girl didn't identify the right color of Monte Carlo. Couldn't be them. Don't want to look at any other.
Did he paint the Monte Carlo? Yeah, I don't know. I have questions. Right.
You know what I'm saying? Exactly. There are questions or follow-up
questions.
Did you
do it at the exact time of day with sun shining directly on it? Anyways, so the police have to move their investigation to focus on the person who is always the logical suspect from the beginning, which is the husband, Charlie. Always the husband. Something that had come up in their normal process of investigation was that Charlie also, like Robert, but not like Robert at all, had a little bit of a temper. He has a little bit of a short fuse. Blaine asks Angie, the oldest daughter, did you ever fear your dad sometimes? And she's like, I think there was a healthy dose of that. I don't think that's nearly enough. And I don't think it's nearly the same as, yes, I was afraid of my dad. I think that is a normal experience for a lot of kids with a strong dad.
Yeah.
It read to me like he was the more disciplinarian and mom was the more like, oh, let her do it. Let her go.
Sure.
It seemed like that was the relationship.
They also don't really bring up any like criminal background for him
at all.
Or any, you know, hidden, buried assault charges or anything.
Nope.
So it's like,
nope.
He could just be, again, like a rough looking dude who's mostly a sweetheart.
Now, actually, we get an interview with Charlie Hibbs himself, and it's really hard to tell if he's in a jumpsuit.
Mm-hmm.
They did a very good job at this. They keep that close shot on his face. We're getting a collar and a face.
Twice in this episode, I was like, oh, I see. And I was wrong.
Charlie thinks that the police really zoomed in on him mainly because of his look.
Mm-hmm.
He says he looked a little scary. He said he was scruffy, and I have not heard the word scruffy before, and I like it.
Okay.
And he talks about his tattoos, and he says he's not exactly warm and fuzzy, but I think he might be warm and fuzzy inside.
Also, they show a picture that looks more recent, the one where he's wearing Super Dad, the Super Dad hat.
The Super Dad hat is on my fashion police.
Okay.
Very good.
I figured it would be somewhere.
And he's smiling, and he looks real happy.
And he has a short beard, and it has gray in it, which mm-hmm. makes me think it's the most recent picture from that era that they have, right? Because, like, if you look at his beard, it's longer and it's not. So I feel like my point bringing that up is that he might have been a little bit trying to clean up his act.
I think you're right.
You know, aware of how he
was coming off or whatever.
And maybe was trying a little bit to not freak out the squares on his vroom vroom motorbike.
Exactly. That's a really good point. But the police are focused in on him at this point, and they go over the timeline of that day, according to Charlie, over and over. But Charlie has a pretty solid alibi. He is mm-hmm. 20 miles away, downtown Philly, doing a construction job with a bunch of other workers who all saw him run frantically home. it's a good alibi. It's an ironclad alibi, actually, because there's a lot of people with him during the exact point in time that we know that this crime took place. Also, he protests over and over again how much he loved Joy. And I have to think at some point as a detective, you do develop an intuition, even if you don't have it at the beginning, of whether someone was lying about that.
Right.
With his alibi checking out, the police are left with pretty much nothing 3 months in to investigating this case. It's a completely stalled case. Everybody has been checked and cleared. There's nowhere for them to go. So the family has to just try to pick up and move on. Charlie says that he had to completely change. He was now the new role as the sole parent, and he didn't even know how to write checks or pay the mortgage because Joy did all of the family business in the house. Yeah. He also gave the house a complete makeover and himself a complete makeover. He built out, because he's a construction guy, all of the burnt out areas of the house, which is why when we see the house, when Blaine and David are there, it looks pristine. He also gave himself a makeover. He shaved off his beard. He became dad, right? He's like, I needed to clean up my act. I'm the family representative now.
Yeah.
It's sad. But eventually, Charlie continues working, but David goes off to Oregon. He goes to college. Angie gets a really good job. Life just goes on. But of course, there's always the hole of their mom. This murder is unsolved forever. David says that he was always frustrated with the Bristol Township police. He always wanted answers. So he decided, finally, I'm going to look for them on my own. So many years later, as an adult, he decides that he's going to try to solve it. And on a trip home to Pennsylvania, he stops by the police department and asks for a copy of his mother's file. They deny his request, which is bananas.
I wondered about the legality of that. Can you just get a copy of your family member's investigation? I don't know if you can.
I think he's 20 years out at this point. When he went, it was in somewhere in the 2010s.
2005, I believe, is when he does the investigation.
Oh, 2005 is when he does it.
Yeah, but still, it's been 14 years by that time, if that's the right date. So it's still been a very long time. It's an ice cold case that no one is looking at.
I think that someone could at least sit down with the file and walk him through it. If you don't want to give it to him.
Exactly.
Sit down with him.
I feel you. And I think you're right, but I think we're about to find out why they would be maybe slightly reluctant to give up a file or two.
Okay. So this is when the most maddening part of the case happens. One of them.
Yes.
They deny his request for records, but he does speak to a lieutenant who worked on the case, who completely sends him into a tailspin.
This is, to me, aside from the murder of Joy.
Yeah.
This is the worst part of the whole thing.
This is horrible.
This was a crappy thing for that person to do.
It was. And I think he must have believed it. And I think he must have thought the son could get some answers out.
Maybe.
But
yeah,
this
maybe.
Is. So the lieutenant tells David that in his opinion, his father, Charlie, had committed this crime. In his mind, he was the one. This is awful.
Boo.
I hope you really did think he did it.
I don't think they did.
And you were like hoping that David could get answers out of him, because otherwise there's no excuse for this.
That blue wall, man, sure is tall.
So David had never thought his dad was involved in this until this point. And this little nugget of doubt planted by this lieutenant throws everything for him.
I think David always thought his father did it because no one ever cleared him, and it wrecked their relationship as teenagers.
No. He says right now that he never thought his dad was involved until this.
Okay, fair enough.
It wrecks his relationship now.
Okay, got it.
So this little nugget of doubt, now David starts reeling in his head and going back and thinking, what was my dad into? Was my dad actually part of a biker gang? Had he piss someone off, someone going in retaliation? He, of course, pulls completely back from the family. Angie confirms this. This is awful, because now you've already lost one parent. You're ostracized from the other.
Who's also experiencing a horrible loss and trying to put their life back together, trying to restore some kind of equilibrium. So it's just like a horrible wedge to put into this already broken situation.
Again, that lieutenant better have really, really thought Charlie did it.
I don't even care.
Did you think he paid someone to do it? How do you think he did it if he couldn't physically have been there? Oh, boy. Yeah. Years go by. David decides this has been too long. I'm tired of waiting. I don't think he knows who did it at this point. I'm sure he's worked himself in circles. But in 2014 now, 10 years later, he decides to give an interview to the Huffington Post and talk about how bad the Bristol Township Police botched this investigation.
Yeah.
He comes out strong to shake the tree, which you've got to do it. I'm really glad he did, because you got to be the squeaky wheel. It stinks. Because it's something that's painful and you're constantly dredging up this awful thing, but you got to do it. Now, his Huffington Post article coincides with two other events happening to create this perfect investigative storm. Dateline's digital series on cold cases does a series on Joy Hibbs at the same time that the Bristol County internal offices decide to reopen cold cases. They start to do a more in-depth look at cold cases that haven't been solved in the county. Perfect storm culminating in, now we have, walking out of the mist of the storm, Detective Mike Slaughter.
Sergeant Slaughter.
Exactly.
Is on the case.
Who is now a sergeant. It's so good.
Yeah.
You couldn't write it.
No. Are you aware that there is a Sergeant Slaughter from wrestling?
No, there is not.
Yeah, there was a Sergeant Slaughter character in the 80s. He was like a drill instructor.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
This Sergeant Slaughter is also a hero. I don't know, are wrestlers heroes? Was he a good guy or
bad
guy?
Well, I mean, we really want to get into it. Sergeant Slaughter was somehow folded into the G.I. Joe universe. Although he was a real person, there was a couple football players folded in somehow, and they were all real American heroes. So I suppose, yes.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. So this Sergeant Slaughter, though, really wants to work this case. He goes into all the old files and says, actually, some of this is solid police work, but he's really surprised that there's no recorded video. See, I think he was impressed by the stuff that you asked about earlier, how detailed they were going back to the store, the mailman, sanitation worker, all that stuff.
Yeah, because it's a, what do you call it?
Screen.
It's a pageant.
Pageantry. The pageantry.
Wag the dog. Okay. Of course, it's corny. It's got to be corny.
There we go.
It's corny. But it's
corny,
a pageant.
It's got to be corny. Are you doing Wag the Dog?
That's what I see. Yeah. But that's the idea, though, that they're wagging the dog with the pageantry and that, in fact, like, they're maybe letting it slide on one person.
Interesting. So Sergeant Slaughter is very surprised, number one, that there's no recorded interviews. As much as there is solid police work, there's nothing on record. There's some typewritten interviews, but nothing on cassette, which is surprising.
And we know that we're firmly in the era of home video, because there's a boatload of home video footage of Joy and Charlie.
So
and
did
the family.
Anybody come in for interrogation? Because I'm guessing they were recording around that time.
Yeah, they probably would have been by that time.
There's also a second surprise. Very much lacking communication from the detectives who had previously worked on this case in the 90s. Mm. It's really odd. They wouldn't help him out. He spoke to an
unwillingness to talk.
That's bizarre. Couple would talk to him. A few wouldn't. And Blaine also thinks this is weird and is like, why aren't they talking to you? And he says, well, you'd have to ask them. I would very much like to ask them.
Sure.
Bring them forward. So Sergeant Slaughter talks about his interviews with Charlie Hibbs, who is the first person he goes back and interviews. He says he asked him a lot of questions that were really intrusive, very personal about their intimate life and adult relations. Mm-hmm. And Charlie answers all of them. And he says, at this point, Charlie Hibbs has been thoroughly vetted. He was not involved in Joy's murder. This is a very cool moment. Dateline does some real great editing here. And this is the first time they zoom out on Charlie. And we see that not only is he not in a jumpsuit, he's in this blue button-down shirt with a large pin on his chest of what appears to be his wife, Joy.
Yeah, it says Justice for Joy.
It was pretty cute.
Yeah.
Good job, Dateline. Sergeant Slaughter then moves on to the next suspects highest on the list, which are, of course, the Atkins, Robert Atkins and April Atkins. Mm-hmm. Robert Atkins sticks to his story. He had a phone call at the house, then they all went up to the Poconos. And April again backs up this story. But April says a few things that raise some red flags for Sergeant Slaughter. She basically erases or minimizes the relationship she had with Joy.
Oh, her? Yeah, we were cool or whatever.
Not I spent hours in her kitchen yapping.
Oh, yeah. I knew her a little bit when we lived next to her or whatever.
She's like pretending that she barely knows her.
Yeah.
Also, at the end of the interview, she tells Sergeant Slaughter, I had nothing to do with Joy's demise, which is a real weird cinematic sentence. That's bizarre. Why are you saying that? Demise?
Yeah, demise. What is that?
Demise, mean? You did it. Like, demise, yeah. You know more than what you're saying. Right. I surmise demise that this is not... Sorry, I'm trying to get there. I can't.
But I feel you. Mm-mm. Sometimes it doesn't happen.
It's fine. Come to find out, Sergeant Slaughter decides to go back to see what the original interview with April is like, because this was weird to him that she's acting a little funny. April was never interviewed in the 90s about this crime.
Right.
Okay. They also find out that Robert Atkins' initial interview was held by two narcotics detectives, not homicide detectives.
Yeah.
That's really strange. He says, I mean, it's...
Ryan? I knew exactly what was happening by that point.
I did not. I was surprised at this.
Early on was like, I think I know what the deal is with him.
Okay.
Not in the first act, but around, like a little bit before this, I was like, I'm smelling a CI.
I didn't get that. So
yeah.
Sergeant Slaughter tells Blaine that he thinks narcotics was running the show on this investigation, which in his opinion is a problem. And it gets for real sure. weird. And there's some thick blue tape that needs to be cut, because as Sergeant Slaughter is trying to figure out more information on why narcotics are interviewing Robert Atkins, not the homicide team, he's got to talk to the original detective on the case. Who turns out, years after this case, that original detective was later promoted to police chief. Basically, Sergeant Slaughter is hired under him, but right. he is also since retired. So he's not even at the station anymore. He's a retired man. Now, Sergeant Slaughter is asked to speak with him before, and he's one of the people that turned him down.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's still being turned down, even though this former police chief is retired. He says, look, I'm coming to your house every day. I got questions. We got to talk about this. I'm just going to keep coming. Finally, after a year, brokered by another retired police officer, the retired police chief sits down with Sergeant Slaughter and answers some questions. And what we find out at the time is that this original detective was told, stop looking into Robert Atkins. Stop going down this road, because Robert Atkins is working for us. Robert Atkins was a drugs informant for the police department of Bristol Township.
Bum, dun, dun, dun.
At this point in the interview, Sergeant Slaughter has to get up. He gets up from his chair and he's kind of coughing, and you see he's got a lot of emotion. And Blaine's sort of looking at him, and he sits down and he says, I'm sorry. And she's so nice. And she says, it's okay. It's okay. I can see that this impacts you today. Why did you get up? And he's like, it's cops on cops. He doesn't like this.
Yeah.
This really bothers him. He doesn't want to go against what he says is, these officers before me who had trained me, taught me, hired me, and I live mm-hmm. here now. We're invested. My family is here. I love this township. It hurts him that basically they have had a murder suspect that was traded in exchange for drug deals.
But I love his comment where he's like, they're a dime a dozen. They're a penny a pound drug information.
Yeah.
I get drug intel all the time. I was like, yeah, you do. You probably do. They let a bargain, bottom of the barrel weed dealer commit murder one.
Yeah.
On the hopes that he might tip them to bigger deals, which he probably wasn't likely even involved in.
Right.
If the only thing he can get for you is the brown frown.
He says we can get drug intel all the time.
Right. I actually think that there's a genuinely decent case that the family could sue the police department in this situation.
I would be real surprised if that's not happening.
They might still be civilly exposed.
We might want to give that a bing.
Yeah.
That very well could be happening. So basically, they said, stay away from Robert Atkins, and they did. And the police, in turn, when they were told to stop looking into Robert Atkins back in 1991, had stopped everything on him. They had never pulled phone records. They had never checked to see anything on the blue Monte Carlo in addition to the black Monte Carlo that they knew he drove. So Slaughter is now going full throttle. I'm going to give Robert Atkins the thorough vetting he should have had in 1991.
Right.
Guns a-blazing. So the first thing he goes after is the phone call that he says that he received at the time of the murder at his apartment. 8 miles away. This is a big alibi because it happened before the Poconos.
Right.
Sergeant Slaughter gets in touch with the person he was speaking to on the phone, said that phone call could have been as late as 1:30.
Okay.
And we know that April was killed sometime between 11:50 and 12:50.
The fire is blazing by 12:50, as indicated on the clock.
Which means that fire was probably set at 12:30, right?
Exactly.
And then he's driving home.
Right.
Definitely could have made it back to his apartment by the time to get this phone call. Also, mm-hmm. they don't check into the Poconos until 5 p.m. It's not like they're in the Poconos at 2.
This is interesting to me, too. By setting up the alibi, he actually makes it worse for himself.
Totally.
Now you check the time and you're like, wait a minute. So this is sort of what I'm saying back to the pageantry of it all. That like, that's a phone call. Hey, when did they sign the registry book? 5 o'clock, ?
It sure is.
That's awfully late.
Yeah.
Maybe we should run down that other phone call because this alibi just seemed to have partially fallen apart.
Both things in his alibi have huge holes.
But it's like, it's a phone call. That's why I'm saying, oh, we ran down. Oh, we checked. We did background checks on the garbage man, the mailman, and the randos. But we couldn't be bothered to call the hotel where they stayed to check what the sign-in time was. Pageantry.
Correct.
Yeah.
Sergeant Slaughter thinks at this point that he has enough or might have enough to actually make a case to the DA. He types this up on Atkins. He was waiting to hear on the DA's response when he gets a phone call and someone has come into the police station asking for him, and that someone is April Atkins. Okay, April Atkins has a story to tell. Blaine says not only is she going to tell Detective Slaughter this story, she's going to tell us as well. And we get to meet April. April gives us a little bit about her background, not much. Basically, that she was bullied in high school when she met Robert, and she thought Robert would be a big tough guy and protect her. Turned out to be the exact opposite. He was her worst nightmare and a horrible husband.
Mm. No pictures of him smiling ever.
No, he's not.
He just mean mugs the camera. I'm like, what's that vibe, man?
You know that vibe.
You do? I feel like sometimes you smile.
I don't like that vibe, but I mean, I've seen that vibe on Dateline.
Isn't like the shirtless and sunglasses in the bathroom mirror vibe, isn't that like a thirst pick, right?
Or a threatening pick?
No. I mean, it's like, hey, check me out. Shirtless, but I look cool. These sunglasses.
Gross.
Like, you know the picture I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know.
And like, don't you want to show some personality? Or what are you trying to, what kind of vibe are you going for, guy, with this?
You know what he looks exactly like in that picture they keep showing? Do you remember the No Fear logo with the little guy?
Oh, you're talking about the Bad Boy Club?
Bad Boy Club. That's the one. Bad Boy Club. That's what he looks like. Oh, brother. Okay. And it's the perfect timeline, too.
It is. Yeah. I mean, Bad Boy Club would be at the height of its popularity, probably.
Anyways, Dateline does this really cool. They shift back and forth between April's Now interview with Blaine, and then they move into her recorded interview at the time of Sergeant Slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
So on the day of Joy's murder, April's getting ready to go to a shift at work. He comes in the door around noon, Robert does, and he's filthy. He's covered in blood. And she goes, what happened to you? And he says, I stabbed somebody and lit a house on fire.
Okay.
Sergeant Slaughter says to April, well, what did you say? And she says, nothing. I said nothing. I was terrified, which I kind of buy it. And then the next thing he says is, you got to get the kids out of school. We're going to the Poconos. So a fun family vacation after murder.
Mm-hmm.
Robert at this point jumps in the shower, washes his clothes, washes his body. They head up to the Poconos. She says he's driving like a bat out of hell. She was really scared about the way he was driving. As they get to the Poconos, number one, first thing he does, he buys a new pair of sneakers. Number two, he takes his family on a hike out in the woods. And at one point he says, hey, stay there, keep them there. Keeps them by a tree, goes off on his own in the woods. He's got a bag with him. He comes back a little while later, no bag. So I'm guessing he buries a knife, maybe some bloody clothing.
Yeah.
Maybe some weed. Who knows?
Sneaks definitely are gone.
Oh, definitely the sneaks. April's really upset and crying in her Dateline interview at this point. I think she's trying to defend herself about why she didn't come forward in 2014 when Sergeant Slaughter came to her door when she was being suspicious, because they were divorced at that point by 2014. Right. And now we're in 2016 and she's come to the police. But you know what? There have been so many years between this, April. Let yourself off the hook. It takes a minute sometimes. But what it took in this case was basically April lost someone who she really loved, who was very close to her. And she said the feelings overwhelmed her so much that she just couldn't get past this is what Charlie had felt when he lost Joy.
Right.
And she couldn't bear it anymore. And that's when she came forward. I'm glad she did. I'm not going to go too hard on April.
No, not at all. I think they fake us out, though, with her. I think they also should give us an institutional-looking top and a very close two-shot. I thought she was also in prison.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because it looks like the kind of, you know, the prison scrubs that you kind of
wear.
Wait,
was she wearing jewelry, though? I thought I saw jewelry.
I can't remember.
I'll have to go back and look, but now I'm questioning.
Maybe I wouldn't have caught that. But yeah, I did. I thought they were trying to fake us out because I was like, oh... She's in jail.
Two fake outs. Wow.
Yeah, that's what I say. I think there were two in that episode.
Oh, boy. But you know what's really hard to fake? Getting a great night's sleep. And the one thing I am certainly guilty of is buying bad bedding. Itching or uncomfortable sheets, or sheets that just simply fall apart after a few washes. Never again. And you too can immediately transform your sleep experience with Boll & Branch. With Boll & Branch sheets, you can feel the quality immediately. They are so, so soft, so breathable. It feels like what I would imagine sheets in maybe a palace would feel like. I am basically sleeping in a luxurious cloud now, and I am never going back. And I won't have to, because the Boll & Branch signature sheets actually get softer with every wash. They're made with the finest 100% organic cotton and are completely free from toxins. Not to mention that these are the best looking sheets I've ever owned. And I'm not alone. These Boll & Branch sheets are loved by millions of sleepers. Over 11,000 five-star reviews. And also, it's not just sheets. Boll & Branch has blankets, the most cloud-like duvets, fluffiest pillows, and so much more on their site. They also have a 30-night worry-free guarantee, so you can wash, style, sleep in their sheets for an entire month. And if you don't love them, you can just send them right back, but you're going to love them. So sleep better with the softest, most breathable bedding from Boll & Branch. Get 15% off your order when you use the promo code DATEDATELINE at BollAndBranch.com. That's Boll & Branch, BOLLAND, Branch.com. Promo code DATEDATELINE. Exclusions apply. See site for details. I am bowled over with my love for these sheets. Thank you so much, Boll & Branch. So now while I have the softest sheets I have ever owned, I am determined to also have the softest skin to go in those sheets. I have recently begun using the Osea Mega Moisture Duo, and it has been such a luxurious addition to my bathing routine. It honestly feels like every day is spa day, which kind of got me thinking, you know who really deserves a spa day every day? That's my mom. So this Mother's Day, you can do the same for all the moms in your life who deserve a spa day every day with Osea's Mega Moisture Duo. It's a value pack of two luxurious body care moisturizers, the Andaria Algae Body Oil and the Andaria Collagen Body Lotion, both featuring Osea's signature uplifting, all-natural, like citrusy scent. It smells so good. And Osea's face and body products are clean, vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you don't have to choose between your values and your best skin ever. And body care is self-care. Most moms kind of have a hard time with those two words, the self-care words. So here's a way to give them a jumping-off point with some luxury skincare. And look, I love the Mega Moisture Duo together, but what I also love is that they work great alone. The Andaria Algae Body Oil softens and firms, and it's just really rich feeling, not greasy. And the Andaria Collagen Body Lotion visibly firms skin in just 4 hours and gives you the most radiant, beautiful skin. I love them together. I love them apart. I know my mom is going to feel like she just stepped out of a spa, and I love that the most. So treat mom to the everyday spa experience she deserves with clean, vegan skin and body care from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code DATEDATELINE at OseaMalibu.com. You'll get free samples with every order, too. I love that. And free shipping on orders over $60. So head to OseaMalibu.com and use code DATEDATELINE for 10% off. Oh, I see you, Osea. And you've done good here. Thank you so much. So Blaine is really sympathetic, though, to April. But Blaine does ask Sergeant Slaughter, did you think, even with all of this confession and everything else, that April might be shifting the blame on her husband to save herself, which has to be asked. And
sure,
he thinks, yeah, I mean, you have to think about it. But he considered all of the evidence, and it's got to be Robert. He was the one in the phone call that David overheard. He right. was the drug dealer. It's Robert.
Right.
So Sergeant Slaughter immediately sends this recorded confession from April Atkins to the prosecutor's office, marked urgent, and just waits for a reply. He waits for 5 years.
That's
galling. My
heck.
God.
Yeah.
This episode should just be called Blue Tape, Blue Wall, and Bureaucracy.
Yeah.
The three B's. So David, Angie, Charlie, the whole family, by the way, this whole time is in the dark. Sergeant Slaughter can't tell them any of this yet. Until they get a grand jury indictment, they can't know about this.
David still thinks his father did it based on the tip. So 2005 to about 2020 is how long David thinks his dad murdered his mom. It's really crappy.
That's not okay. At this point, 2021, this is the reason I think they were made up at this point, though, Jake. 2021, Charlie has retired and moved to the Northwest near David.
Right.
I think what happened is when Sergeant Slaughter cleared Charlie, he let everyone know.
Maybe so. Maybe. I hope.
I think that Sergeant Slaughter is a decent man.
Even if he just did it on the D-lo.
Yeah. And was like, David, your dad is not involved in this. I've thoroughly cleared him. It could not have been your dad.
Yeah.
And it could not have been anybody on behalf of your dad. Mm-hmm. So Charlie moves to the Northwest near, because David is in Oregon.
You're right, though. I'd forgotten that. Yeah, he does move near him.
And it's a really sweet moment. Actually, it got me, because Charlie says he really wished, he misses Joy and he wishes she was alive, but he also wishes she was alive because he thinks that her being alive would have made him a better person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would be a better person today because of her.
I mean, can you imagine how it must be, really, like, your personal growth, you know, like the track you're on is just obliterated.
Derailed.
And then you have to figure out how to be a functional person with, like, this trauma and the suspicious cloud that you live under. And you still have to maybe not act like a maniac when you're being driven to act like that by this suspicion.
My heart goes out to Charlie, the whole family, but this is... it's hurt on top of hurt. It's bad.
Exactly.
But Charlie does decide in 2021 to give it one last shot. And on the 30th anniversary of her death, he posts a $25,000 reward for information leading to the conviction of her killer. And that's his retirement money.
Right.
He uses his retirement money to get the ball rolling again on this case.
Mm-hmm.
Not only does he post the reward, but the family does a very smart thing, and they decide to hook up with the TV crew and do a TV interview, and they show up at the DA's office with cameras.
Right.
They go to Bucks County DA basically to confront and see where the case is at. And all of a sudden, that ball is rolling. It's sad, but there is nothing like a little pressure.
Sure.
From the TV. Press is very useful in cases like this. Good for them.
Absolutely.
And it seems that at this point, the DA had hired their own detective, David Hanks, which I have no idea why.
He looks like Mike from Breaking Bad, except for he's got a British accent.
Is that true? I have not seen Breaking Bad.
Okay. Oh, yeah. He looks a lot like Mike. Mike is like one of those guys, too, like a detective-y, fixer-y type of guy.
But why is there a second detective right now?
Who knows? But there's like two contradictory investigations, right? Like Slaughter.
1991
says definitely isn't Robert Atkins.
Right.
And Slaughter says, you guys are out of your gourd. It is definitely Robert Atkins. And here are some details that make it so, including my interview with April. And so I think they're just vetting.
So you need David Hanks to come in and be like, and I also second the 2014 reports.
This is good investigation, yeah. Especially because, and I wondered about this from the defense side, but mounting an expensive capital cold case against...
they need the most they can get.
Yeah, and they also, it's going to cost some money. And conversely, I was wondering who the heck could have been paying for the defense in this case.
Because the defense seemed good?
They seemed kind of good.
I'm wondering that myself.
Yeah.
So David Hanks is really only focused. He's not really even looking into the case. He's looking to prove that Robert Atkins is the one and gather more evidence. So he contacts April because April Atkins is their best, basically their best way to get any kind of further evidence. And they decide to do a sting operation, a phone call where she calls Robert and tries to get him to say something on a recording that can incriminate him.
Right.
So they set up in a hotel room. The phone call with Robert is a lot. He's big mad. He yells a lot. It's the most bleeping of F-bombs I think I've ever heard in a Dateline.
Oh, you think? Yeah, it was a lot of F-bombs.
He insults her.
Mentally impaired, I think, is what he calls her, which is...
He says, you don't know what you're talking about. You got rights. The Fifth Amendment. This isn't effing China.
Hey, bruv. I know you're probably not a law expert, but you can't just be like, hey, officer, I'm going to plead the fifth real quick right now. So stop questioning
me. Doesn't seem to have an indoor volume either. He's a loud talker at any point, and then it just is either loud or yelling. Yeah, he's a piece of work.
He's a piece of work. That is exactly the phrase.
So he talks over her the whole conversation, repeats the story about the phone call and the Poconos. He does not implicate himself.
And that was interesting that he seemed to be pretty good at not implicating himself and also
he was great at it.
Hyper aware of the fact that he is definitely being recorded.
Recorded. Yeah, yeah. He says, he's like, you know, they probably got your phones tapped.
Right.
Sorry. He has a very weird accent. It's not Jersey. It's not Boston. It's maybe Pennsylvania? I'm not sure.
There is a Pennsylvania accent for sure, but it didn't quite sound like it.
So Blaine points out to Detective Hanks that he doesn't really implicate himself in this phone call at all.
Yeah.
But Detective Hanks says, no, not really. But he does mention in the call something about a warrant. And he does tell his children at one point, I think I'm going to get arrested for something that happened 30 years ago, etc. Neither of these seem like any kind of evidence that you can use.
Right.
Him mentioning a warrant doesn't.
Yeah.
It's proof of zero. But I don't know why he even brings it up. I thought that was really weird. And I don't think this is nearly enough to push forward. He's gotten nothing more than Sergeant Slaughter had.
Right.
Years ago. But surprisingly, this has now gone to the Bucks County prosecutor, Jennifer Shorn. She's on the case. She brings in the deputy DA, and both of them are taking this to be heard by a grand jury. They think they have enough. If you think you have enough now, you had enough in 2016. So I'm not sure why we're talking about this now. I'm very frustrated.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Good God. I think they needed the file to be thicker. I think it's exactly what we talked about. So Blaine asked David how he felt when this was taken to a grand jury. He says he's really excited, but he's pretty angry because at this point now he's found out that April came forward and confessed in 2016.
Right.
So now he knows about the DAs. It's just like they've been disappointed all the way along by all of the corresponding authorities.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to light, Robert's alibi, which had always been airtight, was not airtight at all, that he's a police informant.
Mm-hmm.
David's upset. David says, you don't have to be a detective. You don't have to have training to see that this timeline doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So Blaine, attagirl Alexander, she says straight out, does this feel like this was just a mishandled, botched investigation, or does this feel like somebody purposely looked the other way? She didn't need to ask that question, but she does.
Very true. Yeah.
And it's very pointed. And David says, I always thought this was gross mishandling, but now I think this was a cover-up. People look the other way on Robert Atkins. Angie also agrees with him. They covered it up. They needed to keep their informant. So finally, in May of 2022, the grand jury recommends charges on murder, on arson, and on robbery. He is arrested. We have Robert Atkins in custody looking rough, chewing gum. Spit out the gum, sir. Can't stand it. You don't deserve gum. So he asked for a bench trial. I'm not sure why they decided to take their chances with a judge.
Yeah, very strange to me. The whole game is the defense team is working on the very, very carefully selected jury to sow doubt in some of their minds. A judge knows the law, so they're not going to be swayed by a persuasive argument necessarily, right?
No, I think I know why. I think I figured it out.
Okay.
I think that they are thinking because the judge is also working for the court and works in conjunction with the police and with the district attorney and with all of these entities.
Sure.
I think they thought when they were going to, the things that they were going to defend against the judge would more likely err on the side of they had it right the first time. They would go with the institutions.
We've definitely seen that.
Right. But whereas a jury would be more apt to believe that those guys messed up.
Right.
I think they thought a judge might find that harder. The judge might have more reasonable doubt based it on the two conflicting investigations.
I guess, but I feel that seems like a Hail Mary. At this point, to get this case to trial, there had to be so much light shined on it.
That's true.
You can't have a spotlight on something and be like, we're just going to sweep this under the rug because we got it wrong 30 years ago. It just wouldn't go over. That was not the point of reopening cold cases, right?
Right.
Which is what Bristol very publicly does. So, yeah, I don't know. I understand, but I'm wondering who the defense team is, who's paying for it, were they good?
But the defense team decided this. That was their decision. I guarantee you it wasn't Robert Atkins' decision. It was the defense team.
You don't think so? Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
Robert Atkins' family reaches out to the DA's office with a lot of stories about old Bobby. We find out that when he was 15, Robert Atkins was sent to live with family in Tennessee. His aunt Charlene lived a few trailers down than where he was staying. At one point, Robert Atkins goes over to his aunt's trailer, stomps on her chest, strangles her with a cord, and leaves her for dead. When she's found, she's in the nude. Robert is arrested and charged, does time, but as a minor.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing he was charged with attempted murder.
I suppose so, yeah.
No one knows about this because, of course, he's a minor.
And it's sealed.
It's expunged. So this is pretty terrifying. It's literally the same exact injuries the Joy had suffered. And I think, in my personal opinion, we need to be looking at more cold cases that have this MO.
Absolutely agree. I think now that this detail is out of the bag, I'm going to go ahead and say I don't think this was over a bag of green.
You think?
I think this guy was a dangerous...
I think so, too.
...monster walking around in society that shouldn't have been.
I agree. So, as these things go in pretrial motions, of course, the evidence about the assault on his aunt was thrown out. The judge thinks it's too prejudicial to come into the trial, which is painful, because I think that would be an over-the-top reasonable doubt.
I can't understand that reasoning.
Also, the judge is hearing the case, correct? Or is this a different judge doing pretrial?
Exactly. Like, prejudicial to whom? You know the information.
It has to be a different judge.
It must be. And that maybe that's behind the decision for a bench trial that, like, hey, this is going to be in the record and read out to the jury. Can we get this out of here? I don't know. Maybe it was part of the wheeling and dealing of the trial. I don't know. I just don't understand why that detail would be left out other than the fact that he was a minor.
That's why. It's a minor. But, and okay. I know. No, it happens all the time. It's the most frustrating thing. It's not the only thing that the pretrial judge threw out.
Right.
They also threw out the April specific testimony about the words that Robert spoke when he came home the day that Joy was killed.
Right.
The actual confession where he said, I just stabbed someone and lit their house on fire. If I was a member of Joy's family, I would be real scared at this point.
Yeah.
That's huge. David is actually very worried.
These
are two huge pieces of evidence. It feels really bizarre.
A lot of times for TV saucy drama, they'll do these kind of things and be like, oh no, the trial might be endangered. But I genuinely was worried about the outcome of this trial.
Why are those words excluded? Because it's not hearsay. She heard it. She was there.
I wouldn't have any idea.
Blaine asks what we're all thinking to the prosecutor and says, how are you going to win this case? And she just says, look, bar none, this is the most difficult case I've had to prosecute.
Mm-hmm.
What do you prosecute on?
Right.
Maybe they were in the Poconos at 5. I don't know.
Yeah.
David testifies to the phone call he heard at trial where he heard the actual words. By the way, this is the first time we hear that he heard the words that Robert was yelling on the call. And he says, "I will kill you and blow up your house."
Right. So
how is that not hearsay, though?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe they didn't know he was going to testify to that. That might have been a surprise. I wonder.
Because I think this case is really sewn up by the testimony, you know, because they have April testify again after she's gotten all these statements. And it
I don't know. I think I know what seals up this case.
Yeah.
I think I have a different opinion, but okay. We'll see. Charlie Hibbs also testifies about the vandalism that happens to the house, to the car, shortly before the car. And Blaine tells us that Robert is in court clutching a Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie is on the stand and he says, "Boy, if eyes could kill, I'd have burned a hole right through him then. I looked him in the eyes and I called him a bad name and the judge reprimanded me on it. And I wanted to walk over and rip the Bible out of his arms and beat his head with it like a meatball." Yeah. "You could cut that if you want, but it was just my feelings. The man never touched a Bible in his life."
Yeah, it was great. I genuinely, the beat his head like a meatball.
Like a meatball.
It was amazing.
Was not the word I was expecting. Meatball was not the word, but somehow I was like, yeah, you want to beat it into a meatball? Is that,
or
I didn't
just like the way you beat up a meatball and it gets all mushed up and
that's funny.
That's shape. Yeah.
Really funny. And also the fact that Robert Atkins is sitting there clutching a Bible.
Yeah.
It gives me the dry heaves. I can't be dealing with that. It's barf city.
Yeah.
So the prosecution also has the lead detective from 1991 on the stand and he admits that the alibi for Atkins was not thoroughly checked, mm-hmm. and he was instructed to leave Robert Atkins alone. Mm-hmm. So now we get to the one piece of physical evidence that they do have, which is that tricky blue Monte Carlo, which is important because actually multiple people who didn't know each other had seen that Robert had access to a blue Monte Carlo.
Right.
His grandmother had one or something in that vicinity.
Right.
His cousin actually testifies, takes the stand, and says that she had seen him driving a blue Monte Carlo and shows a family photo that had been taken 2 weeks before the murder. And there is a semblance of a blue something
might
in the background.
Might be a car in the background there. Could be a car window of some kind with a slightly blue tint.
Did that look like
no
a blue Monte?
But I see why they bring it, because like you were in the picture. You have an idea in your head of the space. So you're like, you don't know it, but back here's a driveway and here's a bush. But if you
and
look
this is the
real
back of
close,
a blue Monte Carlo.
Here's, I telling you, that's that blue Monte Carlo. And so I think it works with the testimony.
And that's
it's
convincing.
A two-part thing.
It's good. But April is the star witness for the prosecution. Mm-hmm. She is not able to testify specifically about what he said when he walked through the door, but she can talk about his appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And she can talk about the rush trip up to the Poconos.
Right.
And they play the phone calls. And I think that's what got him convicted by the judge. I think the judge has heard and seen enough that he heard his tone and the way he talked to April on those calls and knew exactly who he was.
Yeah.
And was like, okay, this guy.
Yeah.
I think the phone calls damned him. I think his own words and his own behavior, it's hard to hide.
Yeah.
You know? So him sitting there clutching a Bible and you hear him dropping F-bomb, 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 every other word.
Sure.
Belittling her, but he's sitting there holding a Bible.
You're not going to tell him nothing.
No.
Yeah.
It's no judge is going to buy it.
Yeah.
This is scary, though.
And also, I'd like to take this time to point out that we do not have a motive.
We do not have a motive.
We don't have a credible motive for this murder.
It seems like all the things that they laid out in the prosecution is good. But Blaine points out, too, that you're asking the judge to consider that this crime was committed over a $20 weed deal gone wrong.
And we don't even know in what capacity it went wrong. Did they pay him, take it, and were like, "We don't like this. Give us our money back." And he was like, "No. And furthermore, I'm going to harass you till the end of time." Yeah.
I think they hadn't paid yet and were not intending on paying because the product was crap.
You usually pay up front, though. But maybe they were just that close that they would front them. But I feel like you'd pay up front. So
not
I think
sure.
It's literally just like, I don't like squeaky wheels. And I have a tendency to, you know, horribly
hurt women.
Hurt women.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I think it's just like anything could have set this guy off. And I think you're correct in saying they should look at other similar
100%
unsolves with similar MOs.
But the defense team, by the way, it's the first thing they jump on is that motive because they say it doesn't make any sense. They've also never seen a murder case with so little forensic evidence. The blue Monte Carlo was made up by the police.
So specifically say they've never seen a crime scene with so little physical evidence.
Yeah.
Yet we know that the first responders were acutely aware of preserving the crime scene the moment they realized someone's died.
Also, you did find her wallet empty in the living room floor. Did we try to pull anything off of that? Do we still have the wallet? Could we run it for DNA or prints?
Well, they
had
the cigarette, but that they never ran for DNA, which also the defense brings up.
We find that at the very end.
Very end.
That there is a cigarette butt that was also never tested for DNA, but did we also test the wallet? Who touched the wallet?
Sure, exactly.
And also, they immediately discredit the one physical evidence, the blue Monte Carlo. They say that you can't see in the picture that it is a Monte Carlo, and it is true. It is.
It's hard to see.
The defense team also goes after, obviously, the Bristol Township Police Department and their investigation.
Mm-hmm.
They call Sergeant Slaughter to the stand, which is a twist, because he's arguably done the most for this case.
Sergeant Slaughter.
But he says that he had prepared 400 to 500 questions for this. He was ready. And they threw 4 or 5 questions at him that he had not prepared for. Is that why you asked how much he had paid for his defense? Because I was surprised by that, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because Sergeant Slaughter is no slouch.
Not just that. Just the overall picture. He seems to have a hyper-competent defense.
He does.
He almost got off.
Yeah. He may have had they had a jury.
Right. Exactly.
So the cigarette butt, again, which you mentioned, had not been tested.
Mm-hmm.
Sergeant Slaughter was not confident with his testimony on the stand. They also, the defense lays pretty heavy into the fact that the police had not focused on any suspects other than Robert Atkins, that there had been a similar house fire domestic situation that had happened in New Jersey around the same time as the Joy Hibbs murder. And that was not looked into in neither 1991 or 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So the defense attorney has a few gets here. They also hit on April's credibility pretty hard, which they could, and we knew they would.
Sure.
Because she had lied for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you believe her now?
Right.
This is a strong reasonable doubt case.
I know.
It's troublesome. That's why I really think what sunk him is those tapes.
Could be. It was something, obviously.
So the best part is that it's not that scary. The judge rules correctly.
Mm-hmm.
The judge comes back after just 2 hours with a verdict of guilty for first-degree murder.
Right.
We get the family's reactions. They're a mixture of shock, relief, and we get our title right now. Charlie says there was finally justice for Joy.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge returns the next day with a sentence of life without parole, plus up to 30 years for setting a fire in the home.
Right. Yeah. So I thank you. So he was convicted and then sentenced the following day. So that was like February 2nd was like
that was it.
I believe that day.
Oh boy. Robert Atkins is, of course, appealing this conviction. He says he never abused or threatened April, and all 3 children, according to his attorneys, are standing by their dad. Okay.
We'll see.
There's a lot of questions still about the Bristol Township's police department's actions in this case, and even the judge admonished them for basically prioritizing a drug informant over the homicide suspect.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of unanswered questions here.
I was thinking about this. You guys talk a lot of times about satanic panic.
We tend to, if Kimberly lets me.
So satanic panic often, as you probably have found, was usually justification to run roughshod over people's civil rights. I think this is a case of narcotic panic. 1991 is like the heart of the storm in the war on drugs. Like crack is just starting to blow up. Nancy Reagan made her statements like 5 or 6 years earlier. And so I think little podunk PDs are probably willing to give out these kinds of passes to their local scumbags.
And he had a decently credible alibi if you didn't look too hard, right?
I think that they could have made a decision to prioritize the war on drugs over protecting their civilian citizens.
Because it becomes a one or many, where we're going to save this many people, so this exactly one is right. going to fall into the cold case right. category.
Right. We're the wall against drugs overwhelming our community.
Sure.
And we need this dirtbag on the streets to give us the hot goss.
How helpful do you think Robert Atkins was?
No, I think he was a cheese-eaten crumb snatcher. I don't think he had any weight at all. If what he has for his homies is a crummy dub, then he is no drug dealer. The end.
Thank you. That is true as well. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So we're now at the end. Detective Hank says he's the last person, remember, to handle this case. He says that he doesn't think the Hibbs family is ever going to get answers of why this went so wrong.
Right.
And
no.
he thinks that even when it was brought again by Sergeant Slaughter, yeah, and it was just kind of ignored for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then when April came forward, they're just not going to ever know why. He just confirms it. He doesn't even apologize.
Right.
It's just like,
right.
No, they're never going to know. It's really sad because it's a double whammy of either cover up or really, really bad investigation. Probably maybe a combo. I don't know. Allegedly.
A little bit of a combo. Yeah.
And then it just falling through the cracks. And the DA even gives there's a moment where he's giving this sort of press conference and talks about how we have a lot of cases. Yeah, we've heard this, but okay. Anyways, it's a really sad state of affairs for this family. I feel really bad. But Blaine does tell us in the end, at least they can feel that a small weight of this has been lifted, which they can.
Sure.
They won't get over being put through this trauma of all of this after the death.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a verdict here. And so she asked David how they're doing as a family. He says that they are stronger than ever and nothing brings you together like a cause you can all get behind.
Mm-hmm.
Angie says that she still misses her mom so much, misses her smile and her love and support. Charlie also really misses Joy and can imagine that if she were still here today, they'd be working out in the garden together. And Blaine asked David a question that we all know the answer to. But do you think that if your mom was here today, that she'd be proud of you? And David says, yeah, I think she would. But I think she'd also say, it's time to move on. Maybe get a laugh. That was a very sweet ending because we had seen that video with the hamster when she says,
Excuse me for living.
And then you could see her being like, all right, get a laugh.
Yeah.
Like, move on.
Yeah.
It's very sweet. And that is the end of our Dateline. It was a really good, strong opening episode for Blaine Alexander and an infuriating case. My God.
Absolutely maddening.
Sorry, Jake. I had to do that to you.
Well, you know.
But it's important. Let's quickly move into our B-roll bonanza. We had a lot of B-roll of fire. Trigger warning. If you have a fire fear, this is not the one for you because they show a lot of stuff. Just B-roll of flames. Rough.
My favorite B-roll is the fake Atkins photo phone lamp setup that does a lot of work. Did you catch that?
What? Explain.
They have a slow pan in on a portrait of Robert and then a pan over to April.
Yes.
And a phone. And you're like, where is this? This doesn't exist. This
where
is not
is
a
he?
Real space, right? They're divorced. So do they?
Yeah, what's happening?
It's a B-roll. It's made up. They just use it as a storytelling device. But I was like, oh, they get from like a wall with two photos, a lamp, and a phone. They get maybe 5 minutes of B-roll that they cut through the whole episode.
It's a narrative, all right.
That's storytelling right there for you.
Yes, it is. We get Angie outside on a bench with a cup of coffee in her hand and a watering can next to her that says Garden of Joy.
Mm-hmm.
That was really sweet.
Yeah, that was pretty nice. That was very nice.
We get David looking at loose photos on a coffee table.
Uh-huh.
Sergeant Slaughter also spreading out a bunch of 8x10s at a table in a police station. Sergeant Slaughter doing a lot of stuff, driving in his car, looking at files. We get April on a bench looking at water.
We do.
Somebody else by water. Oh, Charlie, walking on the beach.
Okay, right. The Pacific Northwest beach, I guess. There's bodies of water there.
Oh, yeah. And then we get David walking his pups which is always sweet. And one of them is a Springer Spaniel. I couldn't tell what the other one was, but I like Springer Spaniels.
Yeah.
He's cute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fashion Police.
Oh, we got some.
Yeah, we get Angie's teal dress with the bow. Is it 4:41 time code? Or 4 minutes, 41 mm-hmm. seconds in if you're looking for it. It's amazing, Angie.
What about Charlie in the 50 Shades of Denim?
Yeah.
When he's wearing like a denim hat, denim jacket, denim shirt, denim pants.
That's, I think, towards like, the end.
All different.
He's also...
No, it's early on. It's early on. It's in the early montage when they're talking about
him. At the end,
him.
He's doing another like kind of
is he?
Similar
okay, gotcha.
Look. But he's also painting something. What's he okay. painting? A boat?
Maybe.
I would like to know what he's painting.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some amazing 80s t-shirts in this. At one point, Joe has on a Cabbage Patch t-shirt, but it's not right? Cabbage Patch Kids.
I couldn't tell what it was. I saw just Cabbage Patch.
It Monster Trucks. It was a monster truck on the shirt.
Okay.
What is the Cabbage Patch? Is that like a monster truck rally?
Maybe there was a Cabbage Patch monster truck.
But it was
point.
A glitter iron-on transfer, Jake, which made it...
Yeah, I did not know what that was.
I wanted,
those will make you sweat.
I wanted every t-shirt in this episode. Super dad hat.
Super dad hat. Very cool.
It was really good.
What about, did you catch the Dick Tracy movie ticket t-shirt?
What?
In the shot with the Monte Carlo in the background, one of the kids in the middle of the photo is wearing a Dick Tracy t-shirt. But you may know that that was also your ticket. You'd buy the t-shirt ahead of time so that you had a ticket for opening night for the big smash.
You're lying to me. With Warren Beatty? That Dick
yeah,
Tracy?
That Dick Tracy. It was a huge, huge summer tentpole movie. It had Madonna in it. Don't
I know.
Forget.
Breathless Mahoney. I know it. Come on. Get with the program.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about Robert Atkins' mugshot.
One more thing.
Okay. Before that.
Yes. I didn't know to put it if it was B-roll or fashion.
It's both. Side,
but I don't think it's that. David in Times Square. That photo.
I missed it. What is he doing?
Oh, it's like just looking over his shoulder, grinning hugely as there's all the Times Square lights are, you know, go receding into the.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Robert Atkins' mugshot, does he have eyebrows or not?
I don't know.
I think he does not. Which
he doesn't, huh?
His lawyers, I hope, fix that before trial, because nothing makes you look guilty faster than just...
Than no eyebrows?
Jake, look at me.
No, I know. It's definitely a different look.
It's not right.
Yeah.
It's bad.
I don't know how you fix it.
He's not like a young Norwegian model, which is about the only right. person that can kind of be like, I'm going to bleach my eyebrows and I'm fine. You need to have something happening up there. Otherwise, it looks like you look like a supervillain. Like super dad, supervillain.
Yeah.
It you
is
eyebrows,
a little
man.
Bit Lex Luthor-y.
I hated the gum chewing too. I cannot emphasize
enough.
I didn't notice it. Oh, he walks in smacking. It's like a tough, like this.
Yeah, chewing his cud.
Like a tough guy thing. Make him spit out his gum. Okay. Did you have any titles?
My alternate title is Slaughter and Schwag.
What's the schwag?
Schwag is crummy weed.
Oh, that's good.
Thank you.
Okay. I feel like this could have been called Full Involvement. I was trying to get somewhere
that.
But it wasn't full involvement. It was like partial involvement by the police department because they didn't do a good job. Involvement.
Unfulfilled something. Involvement.
There we go. I think the best title for this, though, besides Killer of All Joy... which is appropriate, Robert.
That's a good one.
Would be In the Weeds.
That's a good one.
I was proud of that.
That one's very good.
Or the Atkins Dial It Back. That was my other one. All right, that's it. He
that
was killing
tortured.
Me. I hated that phone call. I was
there's
like...
There's nothing likable about the guy. It's tough, thoroughly dislikable.
I mean, I'm sure his kids like him, but folks, something is off here. I feel bad. But I feel way worse for this family who's been through years of unanswered questions.
Yeah.
Unnecessarily. Unfair.
Deeply unfair. I'm glad they got some kind of answers at some point.
Me too. I'm really glad, Jake, that you were here to discuss this with me.
I was glad to be here.
If you have not listened to our other podcast, A Date with the Bake, you can hear more Jake. And if you come to CrimeCon, we're trying to get Jake there. So Jake...
I'm thinking about coming.
So use our code DATE if you want to visit us in Nashville. Yay. Thank you so much. And oh, and follow us on social media on all the things. We're Date Dateline. And we wish Kimberly all the best. Get well soon, Kimberly. Find your own joy this week in honor of joy.
Yeah.
Find some joy in something this week. There's a lot of bad out there right now.
This is true.
So thank you for joining us. Thank you, Jake.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Diction timber.
Something. I mean, I feel like there is to television voice anyway.
Yeah. Well, like, I think that's why all newscasters sound.
Right.
Tonight at 11.
It sounds normal, but it's not.
It's definitely, you know what I mean? Not. It's a much more exaggerated way of speaking.
Exactly.
A bear escaped.
I think it's the, what is it, the continental accent, but without the British part.
Is that what it is?
I think that's what it is. I've been thinking about this lately because I think Australian is a southern accent and a British accent mixed together.
Okay. Broadcast college majors, anyone that has done any news broadcasting, reach out, comment below.
Yes, please.
Yeah, we need to know.
Love to hear it. Yeah, and I was thinking about myself and other people that, like, mm-hmm. you know, I could maybe come across, if you just looked at me, you might think I was like some sort of surly individual, but of course I am not.
Is it that you're tall and the metal t-shirts?
Yeah, and you know,
sorry, metal as in music, not as in shirts made of metal.
Metal t-shirts.
Is it your armor that you're wearing?
But I never have to wash them. It's great. You just go through the car wash.
It's great. It's perfect. Sorry, is there a weed store called Women in STEM?
Women in STEM. Probably not. There should be, though.
And with the N as an in?
Women and STEMs. But I guess, like, you don't really want STEMs.
But you know what it is.
No, I know. Yeah, I'm wondering, but it's possible. No, they're all called, like, enlightenment, you know, transcendence.
Oh my gosh.
Sublime.
So the same things that yoga studios are named, you're telling me that's what
really close, really, really
weed
close.
Stores are named.
What is it? They don't use the papyrus font, though.
They don't?
No, not usually. It's not papyrus. That's like yoga.
That's
studios.
Reserved for yoga.
Yoga
Only
studios,
yoga gets to use that.
Hookah shops,
and Avatar. An Avatar.
That's
the movie.
I'm ripping off that stupid sketch that I love so much.
That's it. That's really funny.